Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and here we are. Time for our last Larry Mueller Show book club selection of the year. I've mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again. When we look at books for the year, we look for authors who may reside in Wisconsin. We look for books that relate to Wisconsin, one or the other, or both. And this year, we're lucky to have both with our guest author, Mary Behan. Mary's a retired professor of neuroscience. She writes fiction, memoir, and short stories. She lives in a historic cabin near Mazamani, and we're going to certainly hear more about that cabin. I have some ties to it as well. And her book is titled A Measured Threat. And it is a lovely book. As we talk with her, I want to hear from you. Have you read A Measured Threat or some of Mary's other work? What'd you think about it? Maybe you migrate to Wisconsin, and maybe you want to talk about how you've made this place your home. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Mary Behan, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
I'm delighted to be here, Larry.
Well, As I said, I really loved your book. It was, and we'll get into it, but how'd you get the idea? Talk about how you got the idea for A Measured Threat.
Well, I had written a memoir with my sister, who lives in Canada. We wrote about our boarding school days in Ireland, letters back and forth. And when we had published that, that was 2015, it's called Abbey Girls, I sort of felt a bit empty. And I really wanted to write something, and I wasn't too sure what it would be, but I was willing to try. I was retired, and I came across a cache of letters in Ireland at the house I used to live in that were written by me to my parents in Ireland when I first emigrated. Mm. And I thought, now there's a story. You could write about what's between the lines in letters you write home to your parents from your first year in America. So that's where the whole thing started.
And you wrote it during the pandemic, did you not?
No, not this one. This one I wrote before the pandemic. This was published in 2020. I wrote short stories during the pandemic. That was easier. And then afterwards, I wrote a sequel to A Measured Thread called Finding Isabel.
Yeah, I want to get to that, too. You have a background, obviously, wonderful background as a scientist. What was it about fiction that attracted you?
Oh, the freedom. Oh, yeah. My God. You know, when you're a scientist, I've written innumerable papers and grant applications, and you have to be very precise. There's no space for an extra adjective or adverb. But with fiction, you can say anything, and you can create people that you might enjoy meeting.
Does neuroscience, I'm just trying to think if neuroscience actually shows up in the, I guess it does in the story.
I think what shows up is memory, how labile memory is. And in this story, A Measured Thread, as Maggie looks back, sometimes she's not sure if she remembers accurately. And of course, memories change as you revisit them over the years.
What, A Measured Thread, the title, what's the meaning behind it?
Well, I went back to sort of explain it to myself. There's a statue in Dublin. It's on the corner of St. Stephen's Green near Earlsford Terrace, for any of you who know Dublin. And it's three figures posed in, they're the Norns, they're Norwegian deities, and they're very much like the Greek gods. So three women, one young, one middle-aged, and one old. And the young one is spinning the thread of life. The middle-aged one is measuring it. And the old woman, seated, has a large scissors in her hand. And it struck me that it is a metaphor for the story in this book, Maggie O'Connor's story. And I was going to use a picture of it on the cover, but it's a very depressing looking piece of sculpture. And this was a much prettier cover.
Oh, it's a beautiful
cover. It's a local
cover.
Artist, actually. It's an artist from Wanakee. And I saw this piece in our local coffee shop and tracked her down and bought it.
Oh, and it's now hanging in your...
It's hanging in my house, yes.
Well, it's a lovely, lovely color cover. You have a passage. Will you read a passage from the book, just to give listeners an idea of those who haven't read it?
Okay, I'd be delighted to. I'm going to read the second paragraph, for the book opens at a prairie burn, which is very characteristic in Wisconsin. And Maggie O'Connor, the protagonist, she's 79 years of age, she's helping with the prairie burn. Standing at the edge of the prairie, her feet slightly apart, Maggie leaned against her fire swatter, a crude pole topped by a flap of thick black rubber. Glancing down, she considered how inadequate a tool it was in the face of the approaching flames. She reminded herself she wasn't alone. To her left and right was a line of figures, many of them her neighbors, each of them alert and patient. A few carried fire swatters. Others were better armed, with backpack water pumps that weighed at least 50 pounds. In the early years, she too had carried a water pack, but those days were long gone. Had she chosen to watch the burn from the safety of her cabin, no one would have cared. But she was determined to play her part. After all, it was her prairie. 30 years ago, she had taken an exhausted cornfield and transformed it into a kaleidoscope of color that changed with the seasons and over the years. When possible, she walked its perimeter, admiring its subtle beauty. That was her reward for being a good steward of her adopted home.
Lovely. The first paragraph of the book really captured my attention right away because I thought, oh, she's in a fire. But I like the that there's a thread of this running through the book of saving the land and honoring the land that I really liked.
Yes, and I feel very much that way about where I live. I am a temporary steward, and the stewards before me were wonderful, and I hope the ones after me are as good.
Yeah. Well, you're talk some more about Maggie O'Connor, the main character.
Maggie is 79. She emigrated from Ireland in her mid-20s and eventually came to work at the University of Wisconsin as a professor. When she first came to America, she went to University of Massachusetts in Amherst. That was her first year. And then she went to Germany for 5 years thereafter, finally returning to the States. She's widowed. She has no children. She's retired, and she loves where she lives. And she wants life to go on like that forever. But she has an accident and falls down her basement stairs. And life suddenly changes radically as she recognizes that she can't do everything.
Herself, yeah. Well, you emigrated from Ireland yourself at, I think you, what, 25 years old, something like that?
Yeah.
What other similarities do you share?
You know, it's funny.
Because she's kind of flinty. Maggie can be a little
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she has a side to her. And, you know, I went back and read this book. I haven't read it in 7 years. I haven't read it since I wrote it. And I must admit, I was sort of taken aback by how much of me was in this book. Because when I wrote it, I thought, this is a character. She's over there. Nothing to do with me. Just some good background material. And I'm not that flinty. She's a combination of a number of people I've met over the years. But she has a determination that I think all emigrants have to survive and thrive.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering how your own background influenced the story, other than your own experiences. Are there specific Irish authors maybe you can talk about those you might enjoy?
I love Colm Tobin's writing. Mm. But actually, the person I was reading when I was writing this initially was Isabel Allende. I read a lot. And I have a website and I write small one-paragraph commentaries on books that I'm reading. My sister does the same. We share a website, actually, because, you know, she's a scientist. She writes, too. And we use our website in some ways to share what we are reading and what we are writing and our travels and our family backgrounds. It's great fun.
It is great fun. It's great fun, fun reading your book, Measured Thread, for sure. Mary Behan, our guest, retired professor of neuroscience. She writes fiction, memoirs, short stories, and lives in a historic cabin near Mays Maney. And her book is titled A Measured Thread. Questions for her? Maybe you've read the book, or maybe you just have a question for her. Give a call, the number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about our last book club selection for the year, and it's a dandy. It's titled A Measured Thread, and the author is Mary Behan. And I hope you'll join in with your own comments and questions, maybe an experience to share. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. The setting of A Measured Thread plays a big role in the story. Tell us about Maggie's land.
Maggie O'Connor lives in a settler's log cabin. It was built in 1854. It's at the base of a sandstone hill and in a valley. She has a big pine tree plantation, a large pond, and she also has a beautiful old log barn. She adores this place, and frankly, I do too, because the setting is exactly where I live. I've added a few embellishments. I've changed a few things, but it's very much the house I bought 41 years ago in Dunlap Hollow.
You know, Brett in Madison has something that relates just to what you're talking about. So let's pull Brett in. Brett, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Happy, I guess we got through the solstice, so now it's brighter every day. So that's
a good thing.
Just wanted some more information on the house. I did an 1849 farmhouse on Milwaukee Street that was the last stagecoach stop for soldiers going to Camp Randall for the Civil War. It's 1 year younger than the state of Wisconsin, and wanted to hear more about Mary's cabin. It only took me 3 years to get it up to code.
Brett, thanks for calling.
Brett, I have to say I'm still working on it. It'll always be a work in progress. I mentioned in the book that Maggie dealt with flying squirrels. It took me about 35 years to finally get rid of the flying squirrels, which were lovely, but were inclined to appear at night and maybe walk over your face in the bedroom.
Brett, thank you very much for calling. And all the slides we're at, let's go to Mark in Edgerton. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to, really, a double-sided question, that is, where can one get Mary Behan's books, and where might she be giving a talk about her books? I have not read her books. I am listening to her and wish I had. I think her language is just extraordinary, and she reminds me very much of a favorite Scottish author of mine named Dorothy Dunnett, who passed away many years ago but wrote wonderful historical fiction. And anyway, I love her. The sound of her books just sounds great, and I'd like to know more.
All right.
Okay, well, you can always order any of my books from your local bookstore. If you go to my website, mvbehan.com, on the front page will be the four books that I have. And I encourage you to go to your local bookstore. But of course, you can always go to the other large bookstore in the sky, and they're there as well. And if you like listening to them, three of the books are audiobooks. So you can get them from Audible or wherever you get your audiobooks. I voiced them. And for the memoir, my sister and I together did the recording. We had great fun.
I bet you did. Mark, thank you very much for calling. You took a question I needed to ask at some point. I'm glad you came in and reminded me to ask that question. Oh, my gosh. Well, the cabin, I've got to bring this up. It was known as the Mealer Cabin, and my grandfather, Elmer Mealer, his brother was Lawson Mealer, and Lawson Mealer kind of came to the house from my, great-great-grandfather, I'm thinking? And
yeah.
Then before that, great-great-great-grandfather. And so... For me, and I started reading it without, in the back of my head, I was reading about this cabin. I think, boy, this sounds like a cabin that I spent a few years at, or not years, but days at over the years when I was a very young man, when my grandpa and grandma, Elmer and Nina Mealer, would go to visit Lawson and Goldie, who were the owners of the property at the time. And I can remember climbing that cliff outside the house and worried about rattlesnakes.
I can assure you there aren't any rattlesnakes. Though when I first bought the place, my neighbor shot a rattlesnake off the hillside. So you were being told the truth. My husband is an historian, and he has collected a lot of information about the cabin, but it was a family from Switzerland who came to the United States in 1854 and built the cabin that summer with logs off the land. And you have to think how incredibly hard that must have been. It took them 54 days to get, as far as I know, from Chicago to Dunlap Hollow, driving an oxen and a cart. And it's not a pretty log cabin,
no.
But it was functional.
And it was two stories.
Right, which was unusual. And it had a root cellar in the basement. And then they added on, I think, a kitchen, still a log structure. And they added on several years later another room. And Lawson and his wife moved into that, and their son lived in the main cabin.
Roy.
But there were a lot of children born in that cabin, and people died in that cabin. It has great ghosts, if it has them.
And I remember sleeping in that cabin and going to the lilacs.
Going to the lilacs was a euphemism for going to the outhouse, because it was positioned in a grove of lilacs, which it's not there anymore. But I always thought that was a great euphemism.
Marilyn in Middleton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Oh, well, I was a landlady, Mary Behan's landlady on St. Cyr Road, so many years ago, I think when she first came to Madison about. So I just wanted to call in and say hello, Mary. I'm really glad to hear you.
Marilyn Jacobson, I remember you well. And I have to tell you that the book I'm writing right now, it's The Cabin I Lived In on Your Property features in the current story.
Ah.
It's lovely to hear from you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so it's a delight to hear you.
Marilyn, thank you very much for calling. And you can join in, too. Maybe you've got an experience to share or a question to ask about the writing. I hope you will join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. The cabin, I think, was always kind of a gathering place.
Yes. And I was looking at some old newspaper records before coming on air about basically, it seems like they had lots of potlucks. Neighbors came regularly to visit. And there's, you know, it was something that featured in the cabin, that it was a place where people could always come, gather, visit, and feel they were welcome. And I hope that I continue that tradition.
I think you do. And certainly it appears in the book, because when you think about the neighbors, there's a very closeness in that community.
Yes. And there has to be, or there had to be in the past too, because who did you rely on but your neighbors? It really is quite far from Madison. It's 20 miles. And so, you know, who do you have? Oh, and besides, there isn't very good cell service in the valley either.
The reader gets to see Maggie's cabin through all seasons, which was nice. Are those same joys that you feature in the book?
Oh, yeah. I'm very conscious of the seasons. And actually, I write a newsletter on the solstice and the equinox and post it to as many people as want to read it. It's just a page, and it's about my writing. But I think when you live in the country and live in a house like this, you can't avoid the seasons. I mean, it does have heating. Parts of it have air conditioning. But inevitably, you are not feeling a perfect 72 degrees at all times, day and night. There are times when you're frozen, and there are times when you are definitely too hot.
Well, Maggie, the character, 80 years old, I think, or thereabouts. And Maggie is taking scope of her life, kind of weighing her successes and regrets. Talk about what she was proud of.
I think Maggie was proud of making her way in a new world and becoming a successful professor at a university. I think she was glad of her mother's advice, get a job with a pension when you emigrate. I think she was very proud of finding this property and looking after it, being a caretaker and a steward. She was proud of sowing a prairie. You know, she could have left it in corn and taken the rent off it. So I think these are elements of Maggie. Her relationship with the young woman who comes to help her, Isabel, changes over the course of the book. Initially apprehensive and resentful of needing someone, and then becoming close to this young woman and recognizing something she lost, because she didn't have children of her own, didn't have a grandchild, and she came to look upon Isabel as a grandchild. And at some point during the book, Isabel rejects her. And that too is a shock for her, but there is a reconciliation.
Yeah. She had many painful memories that she buried.
Yes.
Why do you... why do people like Maggie often bury their past?
I don't want to sort of give away the big secret in this book, because Maggie has kept a secret for well over 50 years, and eventually it comes out. But I think I think it's easy for you to push aside something traumatic in your life. But as you grow old, there's space for it to be recovered and reanalyzed, and a space for you to forgive yourself.
Yeah. David in Cross Plains has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, David.
Hi. I just wanted to call and mention to Mary, I think I told her the story many years ago, but my grandmother was born in the valley over the hill from the Mueller cabin. And I believe she was the fifth of five girls. And when the son was born, the mother died in childbirth, and leaving the father with five young girls to take care of. And he had no one in the home to do that. So in the summertime especially, I believe, and maybe year-round, he sent them up over the hill and into the next valley, down to the Mueller cabin. And the Muellers took care of those girls during the day, and then would send them back over the hill at the end of the day to be reconnected with the father, and he would spend the evening with them and put them to bed. And they had nothing but I remember my grandmother having nothing but good things to say about the Muellers, but I didn't know a whole lot about them, but I thought they were childless, but maybe not. Maybe they had children of their own, and I'm not even sure. It must have been the Lawson Mueller family that took care of them, but this would have been back in the early days of the 19th or 20th century.
Yeah. What a cool story.
That's a wonderful story. Yeah.
It kind of goes to, I'm thinking back to who those folks were, and they were very kind and loving people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't surprised me in a way that that's something they would have done.
Well, that story resonates with me because in A Measured Thread, the character Vic, in some ways he was adopted by Maggie's husband while her husband was alive, a challenged and difficult young boy who used to come and fish in the pond. And he spent hours with Maggie's husband, someone who had time for him and would listen to him, would have been the equivalent of a grandfather, but a kind person.
Very kind person. And I'm getting some notes here to please repeat the name of the book again and Mary's name. Mary Behan, and her last name is spelled B-E-H-A-N, Mary Behan. And her book is titled A Measured Thread, A Measured Thread. A lovely, lovely book. So well written. How many, by the way, just as an aside, how many rewrites did you go through? These words that you put together are just marvelous. But I know, having done a lot of writing myself, that it can be almost painful sometimes.
I think the first pass is always the most fun, because you're telling a story. And when you get to the end and you write the end, you just feel great. And you can put it aside, because you're always told, put it aside for 4 to 6 weeks and then read it again. And it's the next 12 or 15 passes through it that are the challenge. I had a really good editor. Christine Collini in New Glarus was an editor for my first book, Abbey Girls, and she has continued to be my editor. And she's very kind, but she's also
brutal.
Capable of saying, you know, you were a bit indulgent in that last 40 pages. Maybe you could cut it down a bit.
To 20 or something.
Right.
Well, the result was it was the 2020 best indie book.
Yeah.
Name.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty nice.
Oh, it was lovely. It's like getting a star on your forehead in school.
Oh, man. Well, what one theme that appears in the book is expectations for Irish women. Back then, you were expected to settle down in your hometown and start a family. Maybe you could talk more about women in Irish Catholic culture.
So I was fortunate. I had wonderful parents. I went to a great boarding school for my 6 years, from age 11 to 17. And that's what my sister and I wrote about in Abbey Girls. We wrote letters back and forth to each other. We were in our 60s at that time. And we just said, do you remember? And we would contradict each other on what we remembered, even though we were in the same place at the same time, 150 girls and 300 nuns in the convent. It was, but I got a fantastic education. So we both went to university, we both went into science, and I got a PhD in zoology from University College Dublin. And after that, you came to a full stop, because there weren't jobs for women scientists in Ireland. This would have been in 1967, and it was unusual enough to get a PhD in science for a woman. But after that, there was no career prospect. You always heard, you better go away and get experience. And that meant going to England or Europe or America to do a postdoctoral fellowship. And then what? Would there be a job in Ireland for you? Unlikely, because men got jobs, because men traditionally would marry, have children, and need to support them. And for a woman who wanted to continue working in science, she'd probably end up being a technician in a laboratory owned by the state or the university. But she wouldn't be able to have her own research career. And that's what America gave me.
Yeah. Well, for Maggie, she did not like these expectations about staying home and settling down.
Right. And, you know, so I put Maggie in the zoology department at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, not too far from the neuroscience community. But she had a great career, you know, in Wisconsin. And I wanted to showcase that because it was such a contrast to what would have been her fate in Ireland. However, I enabled my protagonist to consider what she missed out on when she didn't have a family and a traditional Irish life, because families are at the core of Ireland. I mean, when I go back now to Ireland, I'm amongst women who are telling me all about their grandchildren and this marriage and that funeral, perhaps. But it's very much concentrated on family. And I wanted Maggie to reflect that you make choices and that you cannot necessarily have it all.
Mordecai emailed us. He wonders if there's an ecosystem or place in Ireland or anywhere else you've lived or called home that has influenced you, Mary, and lit the fire of land stewardship for you. And would you think of Maggie's Prairie to be a character of its own in the book alongside with Maggie?
That's a lovely question. And I definitely think that the land, the cabin, the barn, and the prairie and the pond are a character equal in some ways to all the other characters in this book. As for Ireland, a place there, I was brought up on the east coast of Ireland. My family comes from the west of Ireland, from County Mayo, around Castlebar, Westport, Lewisburg, Achill. And when I go back to Ireland, as I do every year and sometimes twice a year, that's where I'm drawn to the west of Ireland. I think Irish emigres feel that it's important to own land, because for generations, Irish people weren't allowed own land when Ireland was owned by England. And so there's that love of country, but you have to own it. Tírgra is the Irish word for it. And once you own a piece of land, you feel secure.
Our guest today, Mary Behan, and her book is titled A Measured Thread. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions and thoughts on the book or just questions in general for her. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with author Mary Behan today about her lovely book. It's titled A Measured Thread. Great to have her with us. And you can join in too at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about, you mentioned a couple of the other characters, Vic one, Isabel the other. Isabel, a very key person in this book. I think you mentioned why she comes into Maggie's life, but maybe you could mention that again. But was Isabel inspired by anybody in your personal life?
I think every character in any writer's book is inspired by someone or multiples in their life. And yes, Isabel is a conglomerate, a mixture of four or five students in my life. So when I would describe her, I would, in my mind, have an image of one of these young women. And then as far as her background is concerned, her mother, her adoptive parents, the mother is from New Zealand and the father is from Serbia. And so I know some students who have a New Zealand parent and some students who have a Serbian parent. So as I say, it's a mixture, but it's lovely to have that range of backgrounds amongst your ex-students that you can tap into.
And Maggie and Isabel are similar in some ways and different in others.
I think considering there's an age difference, Isabel is about 25 in A Measured Thread and Maggie is 79 going on 80. So it's almost like back to those three statues, that Isabel is weaving the thread of her life and Maggie is looking at the scissors in anticipation of the end of her life. But they have much in common. You know, Isabel wants to be a successful, happy young woman in her life and career, but she's frustrated because she doesn't like what she's doing, which is she's a school counselor. She got a degree in psychology and she doesn't enjoy her work. And so she is looking to change. Maggie has looked back over her life and thought, you know, you don't have the luxury of just saying, well, I don't like it, I'm not going to do that anymore. And she makes it clear to Isabel she doesn't approve of her, her drive to just be happy. As she said, you had a good job, why would you leave it?
And there's a lot of tension relating to that.
Yes, yes. And their conversations back and forth remind me often of conversations that I've had with my own students. And at the same time, you understand their needs, but you also recognize that life doesn't often give you exactly what you want.
Yeah. As immigrants, and I'm thinking about, as you were mentioning that, I was thinking about my own students, my own graduate students over my career, many of them from other countries. In fact, probably half of them were from other countries. And there were always issues are that often, I shouldn't say always, but often kind of issues just within their own feelings and their own emotions about being there. And as immigrants and women, those for Maggie and Isabel.
Yeah, Maggie, the excitement of being a new immigrant comes across, I think, in Maggie rereading or having Isabel read to her the letters that she wrote when she first came to America. You know, the thrill of it. And then the reality of life taking over and trying to plan for a future when you don't know what's ahead of you. If you're just a postdoc, you don't know whether you will end up going home, back to your country, or whether you will be able to survive and thrive in this new world. Isabel is from Canada, and she is looking to go to veterinary school. I mean, she thinks that's what she'd like to do, but then that's another hill to climb because she doesn't have all the requirements. And so she has to go back to school and take courses and get some experience in the veterinary field. I taught in the veterinary school for 30 years, and I actually went out to two of my ex-students up at the Lodi Clinic and said, can I spend a day with you to see what you actually do?
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, it's great fun.
And for your research, and you were, obviously you go to Ireland anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I spent a half day with each of them, a husband and wife couple. One was an equine veterinarian, the other is a bovine veterinarian. And it was marvelous.
Well, I don't want to spoil too much of the story, but we learn that Maggie hasn't been to Ireland in 25 years. Why was she hesitant to return to Ireland?
Oh, I think if you stay away that long, you don't know what you're going to find when you go home. It's not that the country has changed. Of course it'll have changed. It's just, do you have the same relationship with that dream place that you remember fondly? There's another Irish word, Tírnanog, the land of youth. And it's actually the name on the driveway going up to the cabin. I have a little plaque there. It's how you think back to, I was young there. I had a great life there. I was a student there. And to stay away for 25 years, what are you going to find when you go back? Not so much about the country, but about yourself. And so I have Maggie going back to Westport, to where my own grandparents came from, and wandering the streets and then going to a beach, Old Head, just below Crowpatrick, and sitting and remembering and thinking, looking back on her 80 years.
And I was thinking one of the very powerful for me moments comes when she sits down and talks about her parents and where she thinks she fell down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I took her to Glasnevin Cemetery, which is a huge cemetery on the outskirts of Dublin. My own parents are in Glasnevin Cemetery, and I've visited at times and sat and had a chat with them. And so I let Maggie have a chat with her parents, a different conversation than me with mine, but a very honest one.
Very honest, and it really caused me to think about my own relationship with my own parents, and they were really wonderful people, salts of the earth, as you might say, and thinking about where I could have been a better son. I mean, I think I was an okay son, but where I could have been a better son. And I thought, I think a lot of people, when they read that part, are going to ponder their own relationship with their own families, their own parent, mother and father.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, it turned into a very powerful, I mean, it's a couple of pages, but to me, it turned into a very thought-provoking few moments in my own life, which I was glad for. I was so glad that you had that in your book. Vic, I do want to mention Vic because Vic plays such a role. And you talk about him a little bit. Somebody in your life, again, is this a conglomeration of people?
Vic is a conglomeration of people. And again, I tap students that I've had and assemble them into a single person. Vic is such a good guy. And if you choose to read the sequel, Finding Isabel, Vic is in there too. And he grows during Isabel's journey. But he's the perfect guy to have as a neighbor. He's the perfect boyfriend to have. But he's human as well. And he worries about Maggie a lot. And he wants to take care of her if he could. And she, in turn, loves Vic and wants to make sure that he will take care of her land when she's no longer around.
Yeah. At the end of the book, and I'm not going to say what's at the end of the book, but the last five sentences were a total surprise, and a lovely surprise, I might add. And when I finished the book, I thought, oh, man, I hope she's written. I would love to have heard a follow-up to this book. And then I learned, oh, there is a follow-up with, what's the title? It's about Isabel. It's Finding
Isabel. I have to tell you, Larry, I didn't expect that ending. I was going along with a totally different ending, much more predictable. And I couldn't write that one. So this appeared in my brain somewhere, and it happened quite suddenly. And I had no intention of writing a sequel. I was done. I was exhausted. And so, two or three years later, I thought, Isabel has wormed her way into my brain and I need to write her story.
Well, I'm so glad, and I'm going to stop over at the bookstore and pick up a copy of Finding Isabel, because I really did want to know. I mean, you made me want to know everything that kind of happened afterwards, because I grew to love the, you really grow to love the characters, sometimes warts and all. But it's so lovingly written that it really made me want to take another step and get that copy. And that's been out a little bit. How did this book do?
To be honest, I don't know, because the thing is, I sort of keep track of it. Let me tell you, it's just as well I've had a job with a pension. but I don't track it per se. Lots of people have said to me they liked it. I've gone to various events where I sell books. Sometimes you sell, sometimes you don't. Yeah. A lot of time you just talk to people or encourage them to write their stories.
Yeah, well, you've written a lovely book, Mary, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and talking about A Measured Thread. Thank you very much.
A complete pleasure.
Mary Behan, the author, and the book A Measured Thread. Lovely book, and I hope you have a chance to read it. I think you're going to enjoy it. We are going to do something next that we're all going to be bothered with or worrying about, and that is our taxes. And another Mary Mellum, will be back with us coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.